You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and you are very welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, right in the studio, we have Dylan James Quarles. And he is the author, and he's also a filmmaker. And his new book that we're going to be talking about today is called There Be Monsters. It won a Best Indie Award, and it is an exciting, time-traveling, explosive, gut-wrenching, action-packed adventure. And those are my adjectives. Set in 1520 and 1985. Am I right, Dylan?
You are very right.
Okay. So we're going to start off today by having him just read a little bit to introduce you to the feel of the book, and then we'll talk more about it. So go ahead, Dylan.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you for having me. I'm going to start at the beginning, because what better place to start? London, England, March 6th, 1520. Silent mists prowled the cobbled city like an army of ghosts. Spreading from the River Thames to the top of Hampstead Heath, the damp fog swathed the slums and stately houses of the steepled city, making them indistinguishable from one another in the gloom. Seated in the drafty study of his leaning two-story timber house, Jonah Munday dipped quill in ink, then scratched out a spidery line of characters on a blank sheet of parchment. Piled haphazardly on either side of his workspace, scrolls, codices, and illuminated manuscripts cluttered the old table like the leftovers of an intellectual feast. Flickering uneasily between the stacks, thin candles cast an inconsistent light that danced in the corners of the room. Glancing up, Jonah consulted the text before him, then went back to writing. Though they ranged in dialect from ancient Greek to German to Latin, he had no trouble deciphering their meaning. As a scion of the noble house of Munday, Jonah had been given an education on par with the most illustrious princes of Europe, and yet this alone likened him to his fellow patricians. Where they pursued ambitions of power, glory, and the sordid intrigues of the Tudor court, Jonah sought the learned life of the Gnostic humanist. Books were his best friends, works of art his lovers, ignorance his greatest foe. A carriage drawn by two steaming horses barreled up the lane, skidding to a stop before Jonah's house. Stepping down into the muddy street, a man dressed entirely in black raised his eyes to gaze at the highest window. There, the light of Jonah's candle streamed out into the street, betraying the whereabouts of the master of the house. Limping toward the front door, the man in black threw back his cloak to reveal a belt hung with daggers. He employed a slender stiletto, thrusting it into the gap between the door and the stone archway. With an upward flick of his wrist, he unseated the latch and sent the door creaking open. Jonah bent his head to an old alchemist's scroll, attempting to make out a set of symbols at the bottom of the page. The hour had grown late, and the candles were but waxy nubs. Reaching for his cup of wine, he discovered that it was empty. The candle nearest him went out with a sputter, and smoke began to trail toward the gabled ceiling. Jonah yawned and glanced over his shoulder. In the next room, his bed was calling to him, promising dreams of ancient wonders and more enlightened times. Casting a final look upon his unfinished work, he told himself that it would still be there in the morning. A sudden draft entered the room, sending a shiver down Jonah's spine. He turned in his chair once more and beheld the man in black. "Diaboli," he exclaimed, speaking in Latin without realizing it. "Who are you? What are you doing in my house?" The man in black took a step forward and removed his hat. Dark gray curls fell about an aquiline face, marred with the signs of a recent beating. Again, Jonah shivered, only this time it was from recognition. "Cesare," he said, almost reluctant to utter the name aloud. "It is you." Bowing his head, the man called Cesare continued to advance. "Young Master Jonah," he said in his native Italian tongue. "I called at your father's house, but Leandro said you hadn't been there in months." "I," faltered Jonah. "I prefer to commence my studies here, removed from unnecessary finery and bothersome servants." "How stoic," spoke Cesare. "Your father would be proud." A beat passed wherein many things were left unsaid. Jonah shifted his gaze from Cesare's eyes to the cuts and bruises which haloed them. "How did you gain entry?" he said. "The door was unlocked." "And what of the dogs, asleep on the landing?" "I see. And what brings you here at such an ominous hour?" Breaking his guarded facade, Cesare glanced down. "I have something you must see." A tube of parchment was produced and extended toward Jonah. "It is a letter from your father, Lord Munday." Jonah leapt to his feet despite himself and snatched the roll from Cesare's weather-worn hand. "My father," he stammered. "Then he has returned? After 3 long years abroad, he has finally come home?" "Read," instructed Cesare. Jonah unrolled the parchment and gasped. Black in the candlelight, the blood blotted the page. "What is the meaning of this?" he demanded. "What has happened?" "Read," Cesare repeated commandingly. Jonah took a step back and dropped his eyes to the page. Words could be seen half obscured by smears of blood. "My son," began the letter. "I pray to God this note finds you in good health, for as I write it, I lay dying." Jonah's face drained of color. "Yes," continued the letter, "Fortuna has forsaken me. Luck is no longer on my side. Thus I beg of you, come to Bristol and sit with me at my hour of death. Young as you were, I think you will remember my absence at your mother's deathbed. That transgression has haunted me for many years. I hope you will not make the same mistake as I. Undeserved as I am of your love, my son, come to me, comfort me, your father, Lord Thomas Munday." Fighting back waves of conflicting emotion, Jonah shook his head. The handwriting on the page was unmistakably his father's, yet the content and tone were utterly foreign. "This cannot be," he said. "Surely it is a jest, Cesare, a cruel joke." The Italian fixed Jonah with a look as cold as it was piercing. "Young master, I have served your father since before you were born. Not once has he ever jested about death, not even when he was visiting it upon his enemies." He turned from Jonah and moved across the hallway into the bedchamber. "Hold," cried Jonah. "Then the note is true? My father is dying?" "Yes," answered Cesare over his shoulder, "and we must make haste if we are to outstrip the reaper." He pulled an empty trunk from the wardrobe and kicked open its lid. "How," pressed Jonah, "how did this calamity occur?" Piling articles of clothing and other travel necessities into the trunk, Cesare spoke without looking up. "An assassin." Again, reacting as if slapped, Jonah put a hand to his heart. "An assassin," he whispered. "Sent by whom?" Cesare curled his lips and spat out a name. "Maleficio." Tasting vinegar, Jonah shuddered. "Maleficio," he echoed. "The butcher of Catalonia? Why? Why did he strike at my father? What has happened, Cesare? Please, tell me the nature of this bizarre circumstance." Slamming the lid shut, Cesare hefted the cumbersome trunk onto his shoulder and headed for the doorway. In spite of his mounting years and the lingering effects of whatever violence had recently befallen him, the steely Italian yet displayed an alarming reservoir of strength and dexterity. "Everything you wish to know is waiting for you in Bristol," he said. "Quit your books, put down your pen and parchment. Lord Munday is dying, and you are the chosen heir to his legacy. Now come, I can hear the rattle of death's chariot already. Pray to God that ours is faster, or your father shall die before we reach him."
You were just listening to Dylan James Quarles reading from his book, There Be Monsters, from the beginning of the book. And this was a very descriptive and ominous beginning, Dylan. Congratulations. I felt like as you were reading to me, I was sitting in that attic room in London.
That's the hope, right?
That's the hope. That's right. That's great. So let's figure out what's going on in this story. Set the stage for what's where you're going to be. It's set in 1520 mm-hmm. and 1985. Right. What led you to pick these time periods?
I was totally inspired by The Count of Monte Cristo when I first read it when I was young. And then I revisited it after finishing my fourth novel. And I realized that I needed to find my own way to pay homage to it. Mm-hmm. So that sort of set the time frame in this like era of like chivalry and mystery. The world still feels very big, and there's a lot that could take place in far corners that we don't have space for anymore, or we feel that we don't. So that was what led me to kind of anchor the story in 1520. The 1985 timeline is informed by my love of 80s horror and sci-fi. There was a real renaissance during the 80s where sort of special effects were just good enough that people with enough creativity could tell these totally bizarre and fantastical stories. Like, obviously, there's some homages to John Carpenter's The Thing in here with the monsters and the way things are very gruesome and a little bit of body horror, because I grew up loving David Cronenberg as well. And also, I was born in 1985, so every date in this book has some significance to me. It starts March 6th, you know, 1520, March 6th is my sister's birthday and my best friend's birthday too. So every little date means something. I like things to mean things, even if they only mean it to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, the 1520s, the age of exploration.
Exactly.
So explain for our listeners where this phrase, there be monsters, comes from.
It's an awesome phrase. It's one of these cool curiosities that comes down to us from early map makers, where, again, you know, the world was so big that it was not feasible to know all of it, especially if you lived in one corner or another. You might only know your neck of the woods, so to speak. So when early map makers were drawing their maps of the world, if they didn't know what lay beyond a certain set of coordinates, or, like, you know, if they didn't know what existed past the curve of the horizon, they would just write there be monsters, because they just didn't know what was there. There very well could be monsters. So I just always loved that phrase, because it like literally spoke to a time when people thought, well, if there's monsters, they're over here, because we just don't know what is here. And I just loved it so much. And then it's such a punchy title. I mean, it was almost one of these instances of, like, reverse engineering. Like, I had the title a little bit before I had the book, and I sort of work backwards.
Okay. We'll ask you more about that later. So there's a lot of mythological inspirations and mentions in this story. And of course, this was a time when people had rediscovered the mythologies of Greece and Rome.
Right.
And so all of that is packed into this. What led you to put so much prophecy and mythological notes into your story?
I love mythology. I'm a big fan of Greco-Roman mythology. Edith Hamilton's mythology. I have several copies. One is, like, taped together. It's so old. It was my mom's college copy that she gave to me. So anytime I can wink at the camera, or I can nod to mythology, I will do it. And again, I love this idea of times in human history when things that we don't have space for them anymore existed, like prophecy, like destiny and fate. You know, these are, like, ideas that people maybe have as they hold them maybe a little as sort of like a curiosity in their own personality, but they don't really, like, let them rule their lives. But there was a time when people put a lot of stock in prophecies and in oracles. And so I have always been fascinated by that idea. And there's a character in the story, a fairly prominent character, who is, he comes from the mystery schools, which is another thing I've been obsessed with for years. And that's kind of an extension of mythology in a way, because it's sort of like these mystery schools were these places where people were trained in the secret history of things and the way the world really works, and sort of like they were given knowledge of the supernatural or whatever. And prophecy was always factoring into that.
I have to say that as times get scarier, and I think a lot of people feel like we're in kind of a changing, turning time period, we're still human and we still search for those answers. Even though things are very scientific, there is now much more belief in time shifting and the synchronicity, as you mentioned in your book, of the past, present, and future.
Yeah, right.
So is this part of your worldview and philosophy?
It is. I do believe that. And I believe that all times are happening concurrently, and that it's just a matter of, like, our limitations that don't enable us to really perceive that. But I think on some level we do sometimes perceive that, like the idea of synchronicity, you know, the idea of deja vu, like these, there's a feeling sometimes that we have. And this kind of ties into what you were mentioning about, like, we live in the age of science. We live in the age of knowing things. But there's a big difference between knowing what the truth is and knowing how it feels to experience that truth, right? And so sometimes people, it seemed in the olden days, we're more interested in recording what it felt like to be alive and experience these things, or what it felt like to have a certain worldview, than to actually depict the truth of the times and the worldview. So that's another thing I find, I get a lot of interest out of that, that notion.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 here in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Today, we're talking to Dylan James Quarles about his book, There Be Monsters. And also, he is the author of a series, a science fiction series called Ruins of Mars, mm-hmm. and also A Secret History of Port Townsend, volume one, volume two, and perhaps volume three will be coming. I also want to mention The Man from Rome, which is an urban fantasy, and I'd be very interested to read that as well. So back to talking to Dylan. Tell us a little bit about how you became a writer, because you started out as a filmmaker, mm-hmm. and you want to express yourself. Tell us about what's happening.
Well, like you mentioned, I started out as a filmmaker. I went to Port Townsend High School. Big shout out to Mr. Welch. He was the video productions teacher when I was in high school and after. And that was a place for me to go and explore my creativity for sure, his video productions lab. And I had a group of friends and we would get together, we would make movies. And I was sort of the organizer. So I would assume that role of director because I didn't mind like calling people up and saying, hey, do you want to come be in this movie this afternoon? Show up and we'll have a costume for you or whatever. I just never felt awkward about that kind of stuff. So I would be the guy to do all that. And we made a movie in high school. It was called La Nuit des Vampires because my girlfriend at the time was in French class. So we thought we'll give it a French title. And it was a vampire movie. And we shot it all at Fort Worden because why wouldn't you if you have that location, you know? And it ended up being in the film festival, Port Townsend Film Festival in 2004, which was like the coolest thing ever to do in your senior year. Felt like a big accomplishment.
What a senior project.
Right? Pretty much. So then I went off to college. The Evergreen State College and continued to focus on film and media production. But similar to how we had made the La Nuit des Vampires, I started making films with friends outside of class. It wasn't part of my classwork. It was something I did usually at the detriment to my classwork because we would be spending all of our time shooting these movies and editing them and all that stuff and having premieres. But then I graduated college and I didn't have that network any longer. You know, suddenly I'm out in the world, I'm on my own, and I don't have all these other creative people around me to help bring a vision to life. So I kind of started to get pretty upset about it. And I was looking for ways to make it happen. But you know, when you have a job and you work 9 to 5, it's really hard to then also find time mm-hmm. to shoot a movie and come up with funding and cast it and all these things. It's like, it's so much easier. So I needed to find a new way to be creative, basically. That was something I could do on my own. And that came down to writing. Mm-hmm. And at first I wrote on my lunch breaks at work. I had the idea for The Ruins of Mars kicking around in my head for a long time. And it was originally an idea that I thought would make a cool movie, and I still do, producers, if you're listening. But I was like, well, I'm just going to write it as a book and we'll see what happens. And I started writing on my lunch breaks, and then I started writing on my breaks, and then I started writing on the clock. I was a facilities maintenance guy, so I had time. And before I knew it, I had finished the first book and I put it out and people were interested. And then there was a second and a third, and it just kind of like snowballed mm-hmm. from there. And once the interest was there and people were expressing that interest and saying, we want more from you, then it was like, well, then I'm just going to keep doing this because I love to do it. And it's working.
Yeah, that's terrific. I mean, you've written quite a few books now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they're self-published.
Yeah.
But they look great.
Can you give some
ideas to people that are in the throes of writing and wondering what to do with their work to make it?
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
To get it into print.
You're right. They are self-published and they do look great. And that is because of the fact that I care and mm-hmm. I want them to look great. And I have my own indie publishing company now, an LLC called Rainier Augusta. And that's all the books have kind of gone through that process. And now that's part of why they have this like uniform look. It's part of my brand. It's really important to distinguish yourself from that ocean of self-publishing with a nice, clean look, good formatting. You know, you put a little attention into it. The problem is that's not always everybody's strength. And mm-hmm. I feel fortunate enough that I'm kind of like a multifaceted creative person. So I don't mind working on covers and I don't mind working on building a brand and doing all the social media and stuff.
So this can be your side gig, helping other people.
Well, that's a long-term goal with the Rainier Augusta LLC was to kind of like not only just do my books. You know, someday I would like to help someone else navigate this world because I've been at it for over 10 years now, indie publishing, and I've sold a lot of books on Amazon. And I have sort of an idea of what works and sort of an idea of what doesn't, because some of my books are much more successful than others. We'll just say that.
Okay, let's get back to the writing. This book has so many twists and turns. I mean, it is so surprising at every page. So how did that come about? Did you have it all kind of in your head, or did it roll out as you were writing? Mm. Talk about, you know, how you organized it. Especially it's in two time periods.
Yeah, luckily I kind of crashed those time periods together sooner than later. I didn't want to keep that going for too long. I love complicated stories. Again, I mentioned Count of Monte Cristo was just such a overwrought piece of fiction in the best possible way. I like a story to kind of keep you on your toes and have a lot going on. I don't do a ton of mapping out. I don't do a ton. I don't have like one of these like boards in my office with like red string going all over the place. Like you see, like it's really a lot of it's up in my head. I kind of liken it to keeping plates spinning. I have a lot of plates in my head and they're all spinning on a pole, and I make sure I'm touching in with each one and that none of them begin to wobble too much. Mm-hmm. You know, I can pull away from one storyline for a while, but I do need to check in and keep that plate spinning. But I like this idea. I've recently heard this phrase coined called maximalism as opposed to minimalism, which we're all really familiar with, especially if you have like a Danish modern kick or whatever. Mm-hmm. I like maximalism. I like spaces that are over-decorated. I like films that are a little over the top and a little overcomplicated. And I like books that are a little overcomplicated, because I tend to write for the purposes of entertaining the reader.
Mm-hmm. It's very cinematic. There's a lot of cuts and edits.
Yes, exactly. In the writing, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's always, and I was a maximalist filmmaker when I was making films. I liked things to be kind of like in the vein of like Paul Verhoeven or somebody. I don't know if your listeners, they'll know, but you know, I grew up on those movies where there was metaphors and there was parables in the film, but not at the expense of entertainment, mm-hmm. you know, and sometimes they can go the other way. It's a very thoughtful film. It's also a very boring film, or it's a very thoughtful book, but it's also a pretty slow read. So I kind of was always like trying to hit that point where, and you know, also in all honesty, like I would love to see one of my books turned into a movie. That's,
of course,
that's at the core of who I am as a writer. So I do write them to kind of like, I want to grease the wheels a little bit. Like if you're reading this book and that's your world and you have those connections, it's not a huge leap for you to take it from the page and put it on the screen. I've done a lot of the heavy lifting for you.
Right. Well, you have a lot of interesting characters. I mean, you have everybody from an immortal, you know, to a mystic.
Spoiler alert.
You had, well, I'm not telling who it is.
Okay, we won't tell.
Okay. The scientist. Mm-hmm. And what I really liked is your protagonist, there was one feminine and one male.
Right.
So that was really great too. So did you have all these characters in your head when you began, or did they appear?
I did. I did have the characters. That's one of the few things that I will iron out before I start writing. I have my premise and I have my characters, and I usually have my like location. I call it sandbox writing a little bit. Like, you know, when a kid plays in a sandbox and they bring all their toys to the sandbox, and then when they're in the sandbox, they don't really want to go get more toys because they're so in the zone. They just want to make things work with the toys they have. So I tend to sort of say, okay, this is my sandbox, 1520s, mysterious island, right? Here are all my action figures, all my toys. And we're going to make this work with this look, with what I have. We're going to try as hard as we can to make it work. Because then you don't ever get that feeling of like the deus ex machina, right? Like suddenly this element comes out of left field and solves all your problems. If all your elements are already fermenting in the sandbox and playing together, things feel natural when they unfold, even if they are, you know, you were mentioning twists and turns. Even with the twists and turns coming left and right, it's all there for you to see sort of from the onset. You're introduced to the characters, you're introduced to the setting, and not a lot changes in terms of like new things being thrown in out of nowhere.
So you have kind of your villain, but he in his own way has his purpose, or you know what he's trying to do, which makes him not exactly sympathetic, but still not entirely a villain. Mm-hmm. But I never really understood really why he invented the meat eaters. Please tell us.
Oh, yes. Okay. Another fascination of mine, in addition to like mythology and and all these other things is filmmaking. I'm kind of like a garden variety conspiracy theorist, like not the kind at all that's storming capitals or any of this nonsense or digging bunkers or buying copious amounts of ammunition and firearms. None of that stuff. I like, because I always feel like these things are some of the greatest stories ever because they're so weird. And then all these people have to come together to work on them together. They're like collective storytelling, some of these conspiracy theories. So like, you know, UFOs and all that stuff. It's like
fan fiction.
It's like fan fiction. It's like living fan fiction. And then you go, oh, hey, that guy had a great, I love this twist this dude just added to the, to this ongoing thing. So meat eaters kind of grow out of that. This whole idea that like somewhere in a bunker in like Nevada, the government is making giant spiders just because they can. You know, it's sort of like this idea that like we never stopped to ask if we should. We only cared if we could, you know? And the villain is very much that kind of guy. He has this device and it enables him to do a lot of stuff. And one of the things he decides to try and do with it is to make chimeras. And part of me was doing a nod to like mythology and literally yes. the chimera, right. Because the meat eaters are not, they're purposefully not overly described. Their facets of them are described, but I never give you this like broad, here is literally what it looks like.
No, you know that there's a tentacle and you know there's teeth mm-hmm. and then pretty soon you know there's spider eyes. But yeah, you can't really see the whole thing. Absolutely right. Because I couldn't really picture it. Well, thanks for answering that question. So what's next for you? What are you going to do? Publish again?
Yes.
What's your next project?
Absolutely. I'm going to keep publishing until I can't anymore. I've got a series of books that I've been working on, short stories. You mentioned them earlier, The Secret History of Port Townsend, mm-hmm. or A Secret History of Port Townsend. Volumes 1 and 2 are out. I'm coming with the third volume very soon. And they grow out of my love of local lore. I grew up in town, mm-hmm. and we all know about a lot of Port Townsend's sort of like haunted history and these fun little tales we tell ourselves, especially school kids. So I started writing stories that were inspired by the stories I told myself as a kid or told my friends, like basically the urban legends that I made up. Because I was always fascinated with urban legends, so I thought it would be fun to be the source of one sometimes and then maybe hear it come back to you later. It changed kind of that collective storytelling, that fan fiction. So I started writing this series of short stories. Each one deals with like a different sort of urban legend or mm-hmm. myth that's locally focused, and they're all in town.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to that and hearing you read them at the castle, perhaps at the library
100%.
Bar. So we've been talking to Dylan James Quarles here on Book Lovers Cafe. It's a program for everyone who hasn't read everything. And we reviewed There Be Monsters, as well as The Ruins of Mars and The Secret Histories of Port Townsend. Join us next time for more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page on the website, kptz.org. And while you're there, make a donation. Thanks so much for the engineer and editors that I work with, Taylor Clark and Carl Allen. See you next time.